begin countdown to Lightbringer's Oath. 3, 2, now.
I pledge to no longer be fashionably cynical even around my coolest friends. I will only express my deepest truth even if the truth is a temporary lie. I will not DJ at parties if there is a better DJ nearby. I will forgive myself for my many cruelties, and I will forgive my friends for their cruelty. I will keep my hot tub at a civilized temperature and bring cold beers to my friends. For this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us be glad and rejoice in it.
Hey guys, good news, you have tuned in. Can you turn that fucking shit off, please, Gary?
Sorry, dude.
Quit it.
Sorry.
I've got a new sound guy, Gary Fallor, and he keeps putting this fucking stupid-ass psychedelic shit in the beginning of my show.
For this son of
mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.
So they began to...
Stop it, dude. Just stop.
Sorry.
It's annoying my listeners... And it's causing my hydroxian light transmutation device to tremble at the wrong frequency, which is producing, instead of the sweet holy water that I enjoy pouring upon my testicle, a kind of caustic liquid that is making me chafe. So please, brother, don't do it. And that brings us to the first sponsor of our show, Kimball's Hydroxian Light Transmutators. Here's their jingle.
If you wish to clean your genitals right, you should use water transmuted from light. Kimball's is best because it is so light. Carry it everywhere, even on flights. Kimball's transmuting device.
Kimball's light transmutation device, available at all Target, megastores, and any place plastic is sold.
You guys might not be aware of this. I just found out about it, but there is a group of people, I think around 50 to maybe 200 of them, who actually have created rules that there are certain things you can't put into your body, even if these things have the potential to heal your trauma and to allow you to become a more compassionate, sweet, and kind person. These people call themselves the government, and they have hired a massive army of men and women with guns and handcuffs who will take you and put you into a cage if they find you with any of these substances in your possession. But lucky for us, there is a team of folks who are currently diligently working at showing this group of people that call themselves the government that one of these medicines has the potential to treat PTSD, which is a psychological disorder that ironically people get from following the orders of the government and going to other countries to blow people up. Just around the corner is a conversation with Dr. Cole Marta, who is leading the phase 3 clinical trials for MDMA in Los Angeles. He is part of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And we're going to talk a little bit about MDMA therapy and PTSD. We're going to jump right into that. But first, some quick business. This episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast has been brought to you by the valiant lords and ladies over at HelloFresh.com. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers your favorite step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just eat, cook, and enjoy, but not in that order. You can choose your delivery date, whatever day works best for you and your very busy schedule. You can get food on the day that you're the least busy. So in between doing all of the mountain climbing you probably do, or the burrowing underneath your house for hidden treasure that you think has been left there by a pirate or a exiled prince. Point is, whatever works best for your burrowing mountain climbing schedule or whatever it is that you may do, that's the day you can get the food delivered. You can pause the account for weeks at a time when you're out of town, perhaps climbing K2 or being incarcerated for a misdemeanor offense that you didn't take care of when you needed to. All the ingredients come pre-measured in handy labeled meal kits, so you know which ingredient goes with which recipe, and it's delivered right to your door in recycled, insulated packaging. HelloFresh offers a wide variety of chef-curated recipes that change weekly. There are three plans to choose from: classic, veggie, and family. If you get classic, you're going to get a variety of meat, fish, and seasonal produce. If you get veggie, you're going to get vegetarian recipes with plant-based proteins, grains, and seasonal produce. And if you get family, you get quick and easy meals with all the yum-worthy flavor your entire family will love. And this doesn't just have to be your wife and your kids. This can be the group of people who have been drawn into the presence of you and your lover, and who understand that the synergy created by your communion is going to send many waves of love into a society that needs healing. And if you're going to be doing that, then you need healthy, fresh, and convenient food to feed your family when they come on home. I may be the worst cook that ever lived on planet Earth. I can barely make scrambled eggs without causing an oil fire. And I was pleased to find that when HelloFresh came to my door, that I was able, using their very easy-to-understand instructions, to whip up a delicious and impressive Thai food meal that I shared with my lover. It made me look like an actual chef. It tasted great. The ingredients were perfectly measured out. Whenever I try to make any recipe, I always leave out one of the primary ingredients and it ends up tasting like goblin drool. But in this case, it all came to my door conveniently packaged, and I was able to make something that impressed my lover, Cooley Fabrizio, and we made love in an Italian villa where my father was translating scrolls. It was wonderful. HelloFresh is fantastic. I don't promote anything on this podcast that I don't like, and it's a wonderful, wonderful service if you're too busy to go to the grocery store, or if you just suck at gathering recipes, or if you just want to learn some new recipes, which is always a great thing to have, especially if you're seducing or being seduced by a brilliant intellectual who is translating your father's scrolls. $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. All you got to do is go to HelloFresh.com and enter in promo code Duncan30. $30 off delicious, healthy, and convenient food. Remember, it's HelloFresh.com. Enter in promo code Duncan30 and be prepared to fuel yourself with some great, nutritious food so that you can wrestle with your Italian lover next to a creek that has been filled with waters from the glaciers in the mountains near your beautiful villa. Thank you, HelloFresh.
Hey!
A giant thank you to all of you sweet babies who have subscribed over at patreon.com/DTFH. If you want early access to episodes of the DTFH, all you gotta do is go over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. And you'll get access to commercial-free episodes, early access. For example, here's an episode there with filmmaker Mark Duplass that I can't even release on this feed until May. There's also an episode there with Martin Olson that's going to be coming up real soon. You can also subscribe and get access to really weird stuff. For example, last night, instead of falling asleep when I took Lunesta, I sat in front of my synthesizers and made a song using the parable of the prodigal son. It's deep, TFH, and it's a great way for you to support this podcast, and I hope you'll do it. Also, much thanks to those of you who continue to use the Amazon link. Because of their rules, we've had to move it around a little bit. If you go to an episode and scroll down, you're going to see a thing that says Duncan Recommends. It's stuff I've recommended on the podcast. You click on any of those items, purchase them. I get a small percentage of anything that you buy. And anything you buy by clicking on that, I'll get a small percentage of. It's a fantastic way for you to support this episode while filling your life with the material possessions that are the only things that can truly bring us happiness in this world. Also, I would like to announce, and this is exciting and strange, I've got a new P.O. box. If you want to send me letters, or if you want to send me perfumes, healing oils, or anything at all that you feel compelled by the Lord to send, you can send it to Duncan Trussell, P.O. Box 26717, Los Angeles, California, 90026. All right, let's get this show on the road. Not only is today's guest one of my favorite people existing, not only on this planet, but on the other 6,432,000 planets that are currently inhabited by wingless bipedal sentient entities, he's also a doctor who is leading the phase 3 clinical trials of MDMA in Los Angeles. And he requested that I give a special hello to Matthew Gardner, Mike Giant, Amber Ott, the Botoy family. May they live eternally in the land of grace, peacefulness, and thanksgiving. And of course, his wonderful family and the New School research team, Paradigma Novum Revelare. I hope I said that right. Seems like if I didn't, they might have the ability to turn my feet into duck's feet or do some other magical curse type thing. Let's say that again, the Paradigma Novum Revelare. I offer them my love. And I also would love for you all now to offer your eternal love to a person who is part of a group of people who are truly doing the Lord's work here on this beautiful planet. A person who is out there on the front lines making it so that we can revise and transform some pretty antiquated POVs when it comes to medicine. Please now welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, Dr. Cole Martin. Dr. Cole Marta, welcome back to the DTFH.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I am so excited to chat with you because what's going on in your life right now has got to be the craziest shit you've ever experienced, right?
It's definitely crazy, and it's been a wild ride, but yeah.
I mean, you are the lead investigator in the phase 3 clinical trials for MDMA in Los Angeles, which is potentially one of the most massive shifts in at least the United States treatment of MDMA. You are one of the people who very well might be laying the tracks so that MDMA can become prescribable rather than just a party drug.
Well, that's very generous, but yes, I'm a part of the large team of people that are working to actually try to demonstrate whether test the existing evidence for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for the treatment of PTSD.
How big is that team?
My team here in Los Angeles alone is myself and seven other people, and there are 12 other sites around the United States and Canada, and unknown, you know, dozens of people throughout the years on this particular project, through the phase two trials, through the phase one trials, all the people at MAPS.
What is the difference between phase one, phase two, and phase three? I think it'd be helpful.
Sure, sure.
Many of us have no idea what that means.
Excellent. Yeah. So when you're proposing a drug for FDA approval, it has to go through a rigorous process of scientific study. So the first phase is that you have to demonstrate that what you're proposing would be safe. So phase one studies are done on human subjects. This is how it works for psychiatry anyway. Phase one studies are done on healthy human subjects, and they measure all kinds of pre and post parameters on like physiological functioning and lab tests and things like that. To just make sure that before we go giving sick people some potential medicine, that we're not giving them something poisonous or something
right.
terrible. So safety, safety, safety. That safety study continues through all phases of the trials. Phase two is
I'm sorry, phase one, is that like CAT scans and stuff? Or how do
it could include CAT scans if there's reason to believe that it might be damaging to brain functioning or something like that, but
for,
not always.
For MDMA, what did you guys look at to find out if it was safe?
I think this is kind of interesting. A lot of the phase one safety data was done sort of in the attempts to find the harms of MDMA in the 80s and 90s. A lot of the groundwork was already done in the studies that were done looking for potential harms when it was first made illegal. So a lot of the safety data was already established from the existing attempts to like find like what are the potential harms of it.
So I right now, correct me if I'm wrong, the harms from MDMA that we know right now are a above normal proliferation of friendship bracelets, proclivity to like stay out in desert environments very late at night.
Ecstasy use, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what else does it do that messes you up?
Well, MDMA, there's a pretty long list, actually, and I wouldn't want to, like, forget too many things, but generally things that we're careful to be tracking are blood pressure, heart rate. We do EKG on everybody who's going to participate in the study to make sure there's no pre-existing heart conditions. There's a potential transient increase in core body temperature. So
I've noticed that. It makes you sweat like a pig sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And, you know, a lot of the stories that come out about people getting hurt are people who are taking MDMA and or ecstasy or, you know, who knows what it is that people are actually taking when they think they're taking MDMA,
right.
for example. But a lot of the negative stories that you hear, things that we have not observed in the clinical setting, like these studies, are a result of either something other than MDMA being in it, or because it was taken in a completely inappropriate situation. Like if your core body temperature is potentially raised by a drug, the last place you'd want to be is in a warehouse with a bunch of people.
Sure.
Where, like there's no windows.
Or a hot tub drinking vodka, for example.
Right, that would be a bad idea.
Yeah, there's so many easy ways to mess yourself up on any kind of psychedelic, but particularly one that's raising your body temperature, and then you're dancing, and then you're...
Exactly.
But with MDMA, you hear a lot of, like, just drink a lot of water.
Right.
Is it actually dehydrating you, or is the idea that you should drink a ton of water based on lowering your body temperature?
Sure. So, I mean, it certainly makes people thirsty. It can dehydrate you. And in those kinds of settings, people are doing things that are going to further dehydrate themselves.
Dancing, sweating.
And
intense cuddle puddles.
And actually, there's a, you know, and as far as trying to reduce harm at festivals and things, there's efforts to try to remind people to drink water who may be, you know, experimenting with, again, you know, ecstasy, street drug. And there's actually been some cases of people overhydrating and getting into danger and dying from excessive rehydration.
Oh, wow.
So it's, it's a dangerous road.
Dangerous road. So, but of course, this study that you're looking at, the settings that you are studying are the opposite of a warehouse, obviously.
Exactly.
You're just looking to make sure that there isn't like long-term neurological repercussions or anything like that.
Right. So far in the studies that have been done, including some long-term follow-up studies, there haven't been any significant lasting negative consequence in the way that it's, you know, utilized in the studies. So it's a very controlled environment. There is even water and like water with electrolytes available, and there's encouragement with participants to, you know, drink water throughout the experimental sessions, is what it's called, sessions where people actually take the MDMA.
Okay, so phase two.
So phase two studies, once you've established safety, phase two studies are the first time you get to really test your hypothesis. And a good phase two study would be randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled. This is the first time where you're actually testing your theory.
Can you explain what double-blinded means?
Sure. Double-blinded means that if you use a placebo and you use your active drug, in this case MDMA, you don't want the participant or the doctors administering the drug to know whether they're receiving placebo or MDMA.
Gotcha.
So that's double blinded.
Double blind means you're blinding the doctors and the patients.
Correct. So it's an attempt to eliminate any bias from knowing that the participant is taking study drug. Maybe you have some expectation that the drug is going to work, so that may, you know, even intentionally or unintentionally influence, you know, the way that you interpret results.
So these participants have never taken MDMA before in the phase two study?
In the phase two study, I think there was, I think people were allowed to have taken MDMA. I'm not totally sure, but it was like a limited amount or something like that.
But it seems like, how is it double blind if you have taken it before? You're going to know in 30 or 45 minutes if you're
right.
Feeling it.
Yeah, that's a continuing difficulty with all psychedelic research, is that the effects are so profound that it's pretty rare that the blind is, you know, maintaining the blind is a real challenge.
Right.
But I would say that's, you know, we designed the studies to be as perfect as possible from like a methodological, like if you were a grad student in like study methodology and like statistics and, then the perfect, most beautiful way to prove your hypothesis would be if nobody knew, you know, like we make these efforts to do the best that we can.
Yes.
But specifically with medications that are going to affect how you feel.
Yeah.
Like I would argue that you don't want things that people can't tell. You know, like I would argue that if you're eliminating things that break the blind, then you're eliminating things that are effective, right? Like, if your allegiance is to this perfect study design, then you're really only going to select for medications that are so minimally effective that no one can tell.
Wow.
Until you start crunching statistical numbers.
Right.
Like,
right.
You want people to notice that they feel better, right?
Gotcha. Yes.
So these study designs are not always, they're not designed with this kind of thing in mind necessarily, but it's the best kind of design that we have to go with.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So that's the phase two. The phase two is a continuing assessment for safety. And now for the first time, you're giving it to participants who potentially have the condition for which you believe this treatment is going to be effective.
In this case, PTSD.
In this case, PTSD, exactly. So phase three is, again, more safety data. A big part of it is getting more safety data. Also, you know, is this just some magic that happened in one lab somewhere?
Right.
Or is this reproducible? Because if you're talking about bringing a drug to market, you're talking about saying, you're saying then as, you know, the authorities on the matter, that this is like something that should be available to everybody with this condition. So it's basically showing that it's reproducible, as well as getting more data for both efficacy and safety.
What are the, in each of these, like, God, this is such a lame way to compare it to something, but, you know, like pilots that you produce for TV, there's some kind of wretched probability that it's going to actually make it to air. Like, it's like a 10% chance or a 5% chance or something. You spend all this time, money, and quite often it just doesn't go.
Right.
So is there that kind of statistic available for these kinds of trials? Like, what are the probabilities that something moves
from go through
phase
all this
two to and, phase three? Like, what are the odds that you even make it to phase three? Is that a rare thing to happen?
It's, I don't know the statistics offhand, but with psychiatry, with mental health medications in particular, with drugs for psychiatric indications, I know it's gotten difficult for the drug companies compared to other areas of medicine to continue to justify, because it is rarer comparatively to many other fields in medicine to have something pan out. There are a lot of like promising leading things in the early stages, but getting something up certainly all the way through phase three has been a real challenge for the pharmaceutical industry. I understand.
Which is why this, just getting to phase three, is this kind of amazing.
Huge deal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. This getting to phase three is a really big deal. And the phase two data is so strong that it's very exciting. You know, it's very exciting right now going into phase three. You know, there are a lot of factors involved, but the phase two data, there's something in the, you know, minutia of scientific research called effect size. And the effect size means how big of a difference are you talking about your treatment making. So the things that are available for PTSD, which are very few in the first place, their effect sizes are very minimal too. So there's, you know, after crunching all of the numbers, there's a measurable difference. You can attribute it statistically to the medicine that was given, but nothing like this. I mean, the effect sizes that they're seeing with MDMA are like, you know, people really see a difference.
Wow, man. That is so cool. It is so crazy, because it's not just as though this is like some antidepressant or some, you know, weird, I don't know, sleeping pill or something like this.
Right.
This is a stigmatized chemical that has been associated as a street drug, as something that burns holes in your brain. And yet many of us who have experienced it in a non-clinical setting, because if you've experienced it, you've probably experienced it in a non-clinical setting, have had our own transformations that come from it.
I think that, you know, something that is hard to communicate the excitement about, and this is honestly, truly, like, what's so exciting to me to be a part of this is that this whole thing is a community effort. Like, these studies are expensive. Like, phase two studies run a few million a pop. Phase three studies run a few dozen million a pop. Like, so where does that kind of money come from? That kind of money comes from either government grants. I mean, even family foundations, even like the wealthiest families that you can think of and their foundations rarely give, you know, $35 million or something like that at once to one thing, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, government grants and pharmaceutical companies who stand to make that on the back end, you know, that's a calculated risk.
Right.
So to have something that it's amazing and, to my knowledge, unprecedented and historic to have a medicine being funded by the potential beneficiaries of that medicine.
Right.
Like, there's no, you know, nonprofit organization that is corralling, you know, donations for Prozac.
Right.
Because people know about Prozac and have felt the benefits of Prozac, or know people who have benefited from Prozac, or, you know,
Yeah, there was no one when Prozac was becoming legal was like, yes, yes,
yes,
finally, right. Prozac.
Yes, we've heard so many great things about Prozac that, you know, this is what I'm going to do with my expendable income or whatever. Not to disparage Prozac. Prozac is a powerful, sure. Like, yeah, fantastic drug, but nothing like this is there. This certainly didn't happen.
No one is in jail right now, as far as I'm aware, for selling Prozac.
Right.
People are in jail for MDMA.
So right.
There's a facet to this which is incredibly promising, because it doesn't just represent the amazing medicine that you and MAPS are going to bring into the world to help people, but it also represents the growing acceptance that psychedelics do have qualities that go beyond recreational purposes.
Yeah, certainly there's growing evidence, you know, for a handful of the psychedelics now, and it's not terribly surprising. Like if you go back to the 50s and 60s, you know, I still think this is a great project for any grad students who may be out there listening to go back and make available online the library of data that, you know, doesn't get taken into account nowadays whenever people are doing online reviews, reviews of literature, reviews of data, because, you know, before the internet, things were cataloged in like libraries. You had to go to like a medical school and some, you know,
yeah,
order the obscure journal and get a hold of the article written that way. In the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of research being done with these same molecules. I mean, even MDMA was around, MDA, psilocybin, LSD, and now I think, you know, MDMA assisted psychotherapy for PTSD is probably the furthest along, and I think that's been an interesting thing to be a part of. Like the pace is like, hurry up and then wait. I mean, there have been like gaps in communication with the sponsor that have, where I like, I'm not sure if this is happening, if this is like all a dream.
Wow. You know,
like I'll have like 6 months of no communication, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, do you have your research team like sorted out, like picked, like we're going, you know, we're going,
wow,
we're going. And then because, and it's not their fault, it's like we're pioneering a path back through all of the red tape of the prohibition. So, and that's never been done before. So, you know, working with the DEA, they don't know what to do with it. You know, like that has been my experience. They're really helpful and wanted to be helpful and wanted to help, like figure out how we do this appropriately and completely by the books and completely above board. You know, DEA has all of my information, all of my licensure information, all my personal information, like, wow, everything they need. But, you know, and working with them, for them, this is, you know, fairly new too. Or, yeah, I mean, it's nothing like this has ever been done before. And so those kinds of logistical things, how do we train, you know? Because it's not just give MDMA to everybody and then MDMA makes people feel euphoric and so of course they feel better.
Yeah.
So give MDMA to everybody and if, as long as they're, you know, high all day on some euphoriant, then they can't feel bad. So that's how you fix PTSD. That's not at all what's happening here. Like, we're giving people MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. So we had to train, you know, 12 sites worth of therapist pairs. Had to figure out how to do that, how you implement a training program. How do you know when they're done? How do you know when they're ready? All of this stuff has been, you know, taken a long time. But to MAPS' credit, they, to my knowledge, on every little decision like that, they've opted to take more time and do it right.
Because it's so important.
Exactly.
It's critical. If this doesn't go through,
right,
then it's going to be not a good omen for the potential of all the other psychedelics that theoretically could be studied in this way.
Exactly. Exactly. But and psychedelics, you know, are potentially, you know, very promising. I was just kind of thinking about this today that, you know, what are, you know, drugs that people use compulsively? Those are the ones that we outlaw, right?
Yes.
And why do some people compulsively use some drugs? You know, if they're mind-altering, then people use these mind-altering drugs because they prefer the state that they're in there, right?
Yes.
So even with the ones that I would, you know, I don't think have much good psychiatric potential, like opiates or, you know, some of the...
Crystal meth,
cocaine, like, that are escapist, you know, some people are attracted to those because they provide an escape.
Yes.
From the suffering that they're feeling.
Yes.
So people compulsively use those. But then with psychedelics, people are compelled to use them and people enjoy using them, oftentimes because they offer something else. And so if you make a law that says things that people are compelled towards to use because it does something, it gives them something, right?
Yeah.
Then we may be creating a barrier where we're cutting out the most psychiatrically effective, affecting with an A, you know?
Yes.
The things that change the psychiatric affect.
Yes.
Most.
Right.
There's a potential that we're eliminating the most powerful psychiatric tools that we've ever discovered because people then become compelled to use them. So these are, you know, in my opinion, like my personal opinion is that they can be harmful and people get themselves into trouble because they're compelled to use them.
Yes.
And so we can't, you know, understate, you know, the trouble that people get into when they are compelled to go towards these things that alter their state. But if we, in there is also going to be, in my opinion, some things that are the most powerful psychiatric tools that we have, that if we can learn to use these tools correctly and safely, might be the most powerful tools that we can possibly get our hands on.
I mean, it's like it's up there with penicillin for the mind, potentially.
Potentially so.
And because this is just the beginning of it. Once you start gathering all the data from prescribable MDMA, and you're obviously going to deepen the understanding of how the mind works. It's not just going to be related to PTSD. It's potentially, I guess, going to start showing us deeper aspects of the human psyche than maybe we've ever understood.
Right, or making at least more easily available and more rapidly available the kinds of deep, you know, deep archetypal, you know, psychological structures and psychological concepts that only come from years and years and years and years of therapy.
Right.
With a really skilled therapist. So, like, you know, with the MDMA, I just wanted to make this point, like, the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, the MDMA, again, isn't given, like, again, it's not, here's MDMA, you feel euphoria, so you're right. Better, and that's when we're measuring.
Yeah.
It's like people take the MDMA in the context of a whole structured psychotherapy model. There are, you know, three preparatory sessions, then the first MDMA. Then there's three sessions integrating the experiences of that. Then one treatment with MDMA. Then three integration sessions after that. A third MDMA, and then three termination sessions. So all of those sessions are dealing with, at least that's the phase two study, all of those integration sessions are dealing with the material that has come up. And, you know, a popular concept going around the community of researchers is, you know, that in the studies that have been done so far, the participants do not believe, you know, they don't understand why this is called ecstasy. Like, these people are working with their the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
Right.
The MDMA is allowing them to have a connection to their therapists, a connection to their own self, potentially.
I'm sorry, I want to stop you there. That is an aspect I have never considered. It's not just opening them up and allowing them to be mindful of this trauma in a way they haven't been able to before, but it's also creating this deep level of trust with a therapist. And like you're saying, that kind of trust probably takes a long time to normally establish with a person.
Yeah.
And you're getting it right away.
Right.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, a lot of people have proposed that that's like, you know, a good summary of the whole idea. You know, some people have, you know, certainly the, particularly the psychotherapy bend people feel like, you know, this is the therapy that I've always wanted to do. You know, a lot of therapists I've heard say that, or, you know, this is what I thought I was getting into when I became a mental health professional.
Right.
You know, these kinds of insights, these kinds of, that you can get with people over a long period of time. But
I'm sorry.
You know, but the MDMA creates a state and an opportunity, both neurobiologically and, you know, the methodology of the psychotherapy itself, that people are able to and ready to work with, again, the worst things that have ever happened to them. This is not fun. You know, anybody who thinks that we're giving people, you know, some bliss drug to like roll around and have fun on for a few hours. And
this isn't Brave New World. You're not giving people soma. There isn't a...
Right.
It's not like that. This is work. This is...
No, this is hard, hard work. This may be the hardest work these people have ever done. Most likely it is going to be the hardest. I mean, it's... By definition, you're working on the most traumatic thing that's ever happened.
You're exhuming a lot of corpses from the basement of yourself.
Yes.
And burying them in the right place instead of your basement. And that is no fun, I'm sure.
Right. The experience that created your fractures, that fractured yourself.
Let's talk about that, because when you were explaining PTSD to me, I realized it's a word that so many of us have heard all over the place, but not many of us even know what it is. Can you talk a little bit about what that is, PTSD?
Yeah, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is a syndrome, and it is, you know, it requires the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, requires an index trauma, and that is loosening up, but basically... you know, it's the cluster of symptoms that occurs after a traumatic event. Traumatic event typically involving like risk of great bodily injury or death, assaults, car accidents, military, lots of things that happen in the military. And then the resulting phenomenon for PTSD is, you know, emotional isolation, increased anger, hypervigilance, meaning like, you know, really being careful of your surroundings, being fearful, having a lot of difficulty with crowds, there's in some people an exaggerated startle response. So essentially their brain has, at least in my opinion, you know, that in my opinion, PTSD is a natural and healthy response to an unnatural or unhealthy stimulus.
Okay.
Like it's your brain switching over to prevent that of incident from ever happening again.
Right.
So you're going to be on guard, making sure that never happens again.
Sure.
Another symptom is, you know, avoiding re-experiencing similar things. So if you were in a terrible car accident, that fear when you get into a car again, you know, can be a symptom of PTSD.
I mean, I know obviously it's not exactly like this, but when you lose your temper, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like you you go to a point when you're losing your temper where suddenly you're like, you don't even know what you're doing. You're having a tantrum. You know, you're yelling. You're like, just went through this with AT&T on the phone, man. Just started just screaming. And was like, realized like, what? Why? Like, I went from, I think I'm about to start screaming to screaming. Uh-huh. And then coming out of the screaming being like, what the fuck was I just doing?
Right.
But that middle screaming part was not really within, I kind of lost control for a second.
Right, with this right. Shrill,
so is PTSD like that? Like you, things trigger a state of complete loss of control over what you're doing, and it's just some random noise or something.
Sure,
suddenly
sure.
You will go into this certain period of time where you're in pure survival reactivity.
Right. I would say that's a common occurrence in people who have PTSD, but So one of the things that happens neurobiologically is that the impulsivity, it becomes easier to be impulsive. The part of the prefrontal cortex responsible for sort of measuring the, you know, all of the factors involved in a situation and making a rational decision,
yeah,
may be overridden more easily. If you think of it from a survival standpoint, that makes sense. Like if you are in trench warfare and, you know, loud noises means you're being shot at and you could be killed, then you don't want to be hesitating to defend yourself and react.
Right.
So there is evidence that one of the biological changes that happens in response to a severe life-threatening situation is that you basically are priming your body in the event that something like that happens again, and that includes having a shorter temper. I mean, working with veterans, one of the like tragic things was how many veterans I had who had lost their job after like 30 years of holding it in. You know, it's like they're not sleeping good. They drink to go to sleep, maybe. They have all kinds of problems. All of this is happening. They're just barely holding it together for years and years and years. No incidents. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows they have an issue. And then one day, you know, they beat up their boss or they beat up a cop. Like, you know, something goes completely wrong that, like, is completely, you know, it's almost like a miracle that didn't happen yet. But, that's a classic. I would say that's a classic like story that I would hear as a provider at the VA when I was there.
This is what percentage of people, or do we know the percentage of people right now who suffer from PTSD in the United States?
I don't know off the top of my head, but when I was in the VA, 90% probably of my caseload had PTSD. And 75% or more were from the Vietnam War. So we haven't even seen, you know, I think PTSD too is because it's, people are grateful that they survived something, you know. They don't know something has changed necessarily till they, or they don't want to accept that something has changed, or, you know, they don't know what is going wrong exactly. It's one of these things that takes, for so many people, takes a long time for them to figure out something is wrong here.
Right.
You know, it's not my fault. Something happened to me because everyone I know who didn't have that experience, life was easier. Why is it so much harder with relationships? You know, a lot of veterans in particular have like limb movement disorders in their sleep. You know, another thing about they don't sleep as deeply necessarily.
They're, limb movement?
Right. So they'll like move their arms and legs during a nightmare. And so they'll end up like sleeping in separate beds from their partners because they strike their partner in their sleep.
Wow.
You know, again, a natural sort of reaction to somebody, to a, you know, that a brain would want to make. Like, we can't sleep deeply, the world's trying to destroy us. Like,
holy shit.
We can't allow ourselves to be vulnerable and sleep as deeply. So, you know, more, they're not sleeping as well. Their sleep is, you know, destroyed, and they're more easily aroused. They're more easily, you know, the downturn sequelae of poor sleep is, you know, miserable.
The other aspect of PTSD I think that gets forgotten is the impact it has on the family surrounding the person who has PTSD.
Absolutely.
And this is where I get really excited about this particular treatment, because mm-hmm. something like this, having the effects that you're talking about, I mean, the where you're getting this incredible data showing that it's very effective, and it seems to be something that is going to, in a relatively quick way, stop the ripples of violence that are going out into families and then out into society.
Yeah.
That's the thing that
that's exciting.
Well, yes, and it's like awe-inspiring when you consider. Because when we think about war, the United States has been at war for, I think, 92% of its history, something like that.
Yeah, right? Well, and I mean, like, this generation that I expected to see working in the VA that hasn't even come in the doors yet has been at war for 15 years, you know, or 18 years.
Yes. 17 years. So we've been in a series of never-ending wars.
Right.
And the amount of veterans who are committing suicide is shocking. It's a it's a statistic. You hear about it, and it's the most shocking thing. And this must be related to PTSD, right? These people are killing themselves.
I can't imagine it isn't a big part in a lot of cases, absolutely.
So, and someone, maybe you explained this to me, I'm not sure it was, someone explained to me that a person commits suicide when the pain becomes unbearable. You kill yourself because the pain of existence itself has become so unbearable that you would prefer annihilation to living. And this, so this existence gives an idea of just how vicious a thing PTSD is. It drives people to blow their brains out. But before they do that, they've been going through this hellish cycle of alcoholism, abuse of their family, separation from their family, sleeping in different beds, feeling like they're out of their minds, feeling like they maybe not even knowing what's going on.
Right.
And so I don't know if there's a measure or if there's a way to measure the ripples that are spreading into the world from this. But to imagine that you guys
if you could stop it in one person. Right.
Yes, if you stop it in one person.
Yeah.
What is that going to... Because, you know, we hear these... I'm sure you know more about this because you're a doctor and you study this stuff. But when you listen to... Or when I've heard stories about how they eradicated smallpox.
Right.
You know, and the first thing you got to do is... like figure out ways to like find out where the smallpox is, treat the smallpox in those areas, and then over time you can eventually just get rid of smallpox altogether. It's a contagion.
Right.
And PTSD is contagious, isn't it?
Like if we could if we had a herd immunity to PTSD. Interpersonal trauma.
Yes.
I love that idea. Yeah. And yes, I mean like you know, I like talking in metaphor, and I talk in metaphor with my patients a lot, and you know, I use the metaphor of a demon, you know, like, because it has all the characteristics of a demon. And we've, I think, talked about this before, you know. It moves through time. It's larger than you. It's a thing that, you know, it attacks you. It destroys you from the inside.
Yeah.
And it came from, you know, in multi-generational trauma.
Yeah.
You know, it came from the generation before.
Yeah.
You know, cycles of abuse, you know, abusive parents lead to children who are much more likely to become abusive parents themselves.
Yeah.
Like these sort of evil entities.
Yes.
That move through time, you know, and move through people.
Have you thought about this quote? Have you thought about, because what you're talking about, and I know you mean it in metaphor, obviously.
Exactly. I mean, I believe there's epigenetic and biological and deep psychological explanations. I just enjoy the metaphor of like
metaphor
visualizing, like stopping one of these things and saving like you said, that ripple effect that comes out of everybody who's affected by a trauma. I mean, if you've been traumatized, you are more likely to, like, you know, have that description that we went through
trauma.
To also in turn traumatize your
yes,
exactly.
So, but this is where when you're talking, and especially now that I've realized that the effect of this treatment is amplifying the bond between patient and therapist.
Absolutely.
At that point, we have this fascinating Western mirror of the shaman. And it is identical. The language is different. The settings are obviously different. You're not sitting in front of a fire. You're not outside or in some hut in the Amazon. You're sitting in some probably very comfortable spot across from a therapist. But when you think about how in shamanism, we have this idea of the sick soul. We have this idea of a spiritual disorder, which some people describe as a kind of darkness that gets stuck inside of you. And that through the process of taking some shamanic plant medicine, ayahuasca being the one that many people are experiencing, this darkness inside of you gets purged in some way or another, and you are reborn into a new life.
Yeah.
With this, it's like a Western version of shamanism, which is that you, truly the therapist becomes the shaman almost. The only difference is the therapist is not taking MDMA with the patient.
And, you know, I think an important distinction to make is, and that gets to a whole, current conundrum, but, a big difference is, from what I understand from shamanistic traditions, is that the shaman leads the person. Like, the shaman is the knowledgeable of the spirit world, or the place that people are going to with these medicines. And the shaman is like their shepherd.
Yeah.
In some way, you know, or participates in some way.
Surgeon. Like some kind of surgeon. The shaman is like, is somehow able to see into you in ways that you can't see into you, that the shaman is actually seeing the energetic forms inside of you that are creating the energy blocks, and in some way clearing those blocks.
Sure.
Or helping you clear the blocks.
So a big difference between that and what is happening in the way that I'm getting trained is that we are not guiding people. We don't know the answer any more than the fresh participant does. That we're there to help facilitate a process that is coming from within.
Right.
That there's a core central belief of the therapy model, which is available to anybody. This is, you know, there's full transparency in the whole process. Of this study, but one of the core tenets is the concept of an internal healing intelligence, that everyone has a, you know, like we have biologically, a tendency towards healing and wholeness, that a analogous thing is available in the psyche.
Okay, so this is something I was just reading about, and I love it, which is, there's this idea of, and this is in Hinduism, there's the idea that within the human, there's the human soul, but the human soul is wrapped around or next to the eternal soul, or the, it's the Atman in something called the Para-Atman. And the Para-Atman is the, you know, soul of the divine. So like the Bhagavad Gita, we have Krishna in the chariot, who is instructing Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, why he should fight. And this is a metaphor for the higher self within humans that speaks to you. The chariot, of course, is your body. The higher self is the thing you're talking about. What was it called?
The internal healing intelligence.
Yeah, that's Krishna. The internal healing intelligence is Krishna, who is just inside of you trying to have a conversation with you about why it makes sense to live, why it makes sense to act, why it makes sense to be a person in the world that is doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that you are in a, this is a sort of Western version of that, which yeah. is you within this process is maybe helping people listen to that beautiful thing that is within us, which probably gets drowned out by the fear.
Right. Right. Now, I think, you know, it's never surprising to me when, you know, philosophies that are studying the mind come to very similar conclusions like that, you know,
yeah.
not surprising that, you know, Buddhist and Hindu philosophy a lot of times, and, you know, overlaps with psychology, you know, a lot
sure.
of the findings of psychology and deep psychology. You know, there was a really great description by Michael Mithoffer, who did the phase two studies with MDMA, assisted psychotherapy for PTSD, and is a great, amazing person and mentor. He gives this analogy that he was originally an emergency medicine doctor, went back and studied psychiatry after. But if you come to the emergency room with a cut on your arm, the doctor doesn't heal the wound. The doctor just gets all of the crap out of there. The doctor knows
yeah.
what gets in the way, maybe.
Right.
The doctor cleans it. Doctor may stitch it so that it can, you know,
yeah.
bring the two pieces of skin back together so
yeah.
they can do what they do. The doctor doesn't know how to make skin come back together. Doctor doesn't know how to make a scar. A doctor doesn't create that. Like, you have an internal drive towards repairing and healing, and that's one of the core concepts.
What? But this is, I mean, it's, this sounds, is this concept of that internal healing in the psyche, is this a new concept, or has this been around for a while?
Does this have a
lineage? What is it?
Sure. Yeah. As far as, if I don't want to get this wrong, but I'm pretty confident that this came from Stanislav Grof, from his work with, he had an academic career at Johns Hopkins University in the 60s, working with LSD and LSD-assisted psychotherapy back when it was completely legal and above board. A lot, you know, the generation doing the work now looks to a lot of the people from that generation are still around to and are creating, you know, the guides, or at least a big part of the conversation creating a lot of these guides, as far as I know.
I love this. It's just so fascinating to imagine that you're like, okay, so I've got this beautiful Moog Sub 37. I love it. And the thing gets out of tune, believe it or not. It's not a digital keyboard. It, like, so you have to tune it sometimes. It'll tune itself, though. There's like a program you can run it through where it'll play tones, and I don't know how it does it, but somehow it'll tune itself back to the way it was before. So when it gets out of tune, sometimes you have to tune it. It's just fascinating to imagine that within the human psyche, there's a kind of tuning fork
right.
that if you can hear it, in the right state of consciousness, then the part of you that's become out of equilibrium with it can potentially reharmonize with that.
Right. Yeah, you know, the participants in these studies, they know something's off, right?
Yes.
And a lot of times the material is too, there is a part of the brain that actually, you know, actively is trying to block you from thinking about that stuff.
Yes.
You know, there's missing data, something's wrong.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the way that I envision it. There are a lot of beautiful ways that this modality functions. One of them that has occurred to me also is that one inherent flaw of, like, a talking psychotherapy and, you know, hoping that the therapist has the answers. And
yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of psychotherapy models, including, you know, rigid psychoanalysis, that, you know, that's an assumption of the patient coming in, that the therapist is going to have some wisdom that they don't have.
Yes.
That they're going to to listen to their story and go, like the answer is A plus B equals D. You just didn't know that. I know that because I've studied this all my life.
Yeah.
Whatever, right? but that's not the case, really. And a lot of times what it is that's missing may not even be something that we have a language for. I mean, we're talking about like deep psychological scars. And, you know, when this healing is taking place, we're hearing like metaphors coming up, you know, Jungian archetypes.
Yeah, I get it. These are like the stuff that's that you're sort of drawing out of the well of the soul. This is stuff that just who knows, you know, this is, we're looking at like, you know, like when they pull up shit out of the trench, the Marianas Trench,
right,
and they pull up shit out of there that would make your fucking hair turn white.
Aliens.
Just like glowing puffed things that the moment they land on the fish that or the boat, they just
explode
from the, so you see it for a second, some kind of screaming merchild with like horns, like what the fuck was that? And it melts. Like, so
that's a good metaphor right there. And often in Jungian archetypes, the ocean is a symbol of the mind. So that was perfect. That was a metaphor. That was like meta metaphor.
So,
perfect.
So yeah, we don't even, I mean, because of the nature of psychedelics, this is like you're saying, you guys are pioneering a way of understanding how to deal with that kind of mind material from the deep, deep minds of the human self.
Right. And in, you know, in the session, we often, you know, a lot of, there is actually, in the protocol, you know, encouraging people to go inward and to not be engaging necessarily the whole time in some sort of conversation that really a process is going to arise naturally from within you. And we are here to support you through that process.
So you actually encourage people not to talk so much.
Yeah, there are.
So like when people start talking, you guys are like, shut the fuck up and heal.
Right, exactly. No, in the phase two studies, I was an independent rater, which means I watched videos of the therapy that had occurred, and also in the training we watched a lot of the videos. And we actually graded the therapists. This was an internal sort of way of making sure that the therapists are A, doing the therapy correctly, and B, that if somebody didn't respond, is that because the treatment doesn't work, or is that because the therapist didn't do the therapy manual? So on this grading sheet, like, encouraging them to go inward is like one of the things we grade therapists on. Like, did you take time? Did you offer the opportunity? Did you even like, you know, encourage someone to put on headphones, listen to music, and go inward for a little while?
God, this is something in the psychedelic experience that just gets left out altogether. Because when people take psychedelics, my experience of taking psychedelics with a group is it's a lot of talking. And maybe at some point, you know, hopefully like a cuddle puddle will form and people will like stop talking so much and, you know, it'll just be more of like expressions of affection. But in general, I think the way a lot of us take psychedelics when we're not going out dancing or whatever is to talk. Like, it's almost like it's expected that you should be talking.
Right. Yeah. I mean, definitely in all of the work that is being done exploring these psilocybin, MDMA, exploring these as medicines, there's a lot of internal. I mean, there's almost no talking in the psilocybin protocols, from what I understand. From what I understand, in fact, you're like the therapist's job. From what I understand, I have a friend who worked on one of the studies there that at Johns Hopkins, and said that primarily you're discouraging them anytime they try to get out of the headphones and eye shades.
You know, like,
not that it's like forced upon them or anything, but like the manual, like the modality for the psilocybin work is taking this psilocybin dose, then going inward until it's done.
Wow.
more or less.
That's the work. That's why it's work. Because fuck that. Because when you're spiraling down into that place and you start seeing the things.
Right.
Holy shit, man. I get it. Right. You, like,
the work is internal.
About, yes.
Yeah.
Because, oh my God, I guess I'm using, yeah, I use being a yapper as a kind of way to evade the gnashing teeth.
Right. And that's part of the training manual too is, you know, you do have some time of, you know, you don't want somebody to be, well, I guess if somebody is moving right along and feeling like things are going in the right way and you're convinced they're doing good work, you don't have to pull them out of the eye shades and headphones. But, you know, the idea is that you kind of offer both, you know, time going inward and time talking. And that, too, is part of the training manual that I've seen that, you know, if somebody is just talking, you know, it could be a form of, you know, avoidance, you know. And so if the talking doesn't seem to be productive anymore, it's sort of toggling back and forth between going inward, having something that needs to be expressed or talked about, supporting them through that realization or insight or thing, and then like, okay, so we work through that. All right, let's go back in.
Are y'all concerned that this methodology that you've created is going to be picked up by people and used outside of prescribable MDMA? Because the MDMA is not the most difficult thing to discover, and it seems like you could just get some MDMA and someone could just use what you guys have learned. Do you feel, I mean, I'm not saying that's bad, I think it could be great, but because of your role,
sure.
Do you kind of feel a little like hogtied? Like you can't, you know, when you talk about things, you have to be careful to say, we are doing this within this zone of safety.
In this context.
But you can't then say, I mean, but if you guys were going to do it, here's some things you could do.
I mean, I think I do worry about that. I worry because, you know, I think it's unethical to experiment on people. I mean, the informed consent process for this alone is, you know, an entire session, you know, like hour to hour and a half meeting of going through, making sure somebody really knows what they're signing up for. This is still experimental, you know?
Right.
And I think it's putting the cart before the horse to be trying to treat especially if you aren't appropriately trained in the modality, even if you can get access to the manual, it's still in this context anyway. There is at least one trained mental health professional, which comes with its own whole licensing process and accreditation. So, you know, they at least know what not to do. And one person, the second of the therapist pair is expected to be either working towards that credentialing or also have a credential.
So, I get it, but clearly there's going to be offshoots of this. I mean, it's like the, and I know that you guys have to be supremely careful and responsible and ethical, and your entire training is based around that. But to me, this stuff is really exciting because of the, not just because it treats PTSD, which I have had a direct experience with in my life and I understand just how brutal it is, but also because this is going to create a practical, responsible model for many of us who don't have PTSD and might not be eligible for these kind of studies to take psychedelics in a truly more effective way based on strong data. And I know you can't say yay or nay to that, but that is going to happen. But and that's something that's really exciting to folks like me, I think, because we are believers in the idea that one of the pathways to up-leveling the human species, to shifting society, to producing groundbreaking changes, to harvesting, as of yet, maybe inaccessible epiphanies that are just waiting in the depths of a person's heart, if only they could have the courage to gaze in there. All these things are going to come from this study that don't really have much to do with the core reason behind the study. That's what's exciting to me. Because right now, what do we have? Think of the manuals we have for tripping. We have the psychedelic experience, which is great. You know, Ram Dass, Metzner,
Leary.
Yeah. And that's a great guidebook. He's in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I'm sure there's other guides to it. But this is going to produce a methodology that we can use personally in a non-licensed way that potentially could be very, very transformative for us.
Well, I think that I share your excitement and I think vision for the potential of it. And I think it's just important that the foundation is solid. I think that that is the error of the 60s and 70s that led to an easy demonization of the communities of people who use psychedelics. And, you know, there are lots of reasons that it became illegal. That it was like a whole other series of podcasts. But one of them is that it's easy to, you know, villainize these groups. And so I think we have, by doing it right, it's slow and it requires a lot of patience.
Yes.
And I understand wholly that people are suffering now.
Right.
And I don't personally, you know, I don't know what to tell them, you know, except that we're going as fast as we can, but that it moves very, very slow.
Yes.
But it's on the way. And I think this is critical. We need people to come and do these studies. Like, if there's a study going on right now, you can go to clinicaltrials.gov and look not only at our study, but there is a study going on right now for people who have a family member who has PTSD. Mm-hmm. And it's a couples thing, but it's not just for, you know, intimate couples. It's for a pair where one has PTSD and the other is a primary family member.
Yeah.
And they both take MDMA.
Wow.
And it's a therapy model looking at the safety and efficacy of that. I mean, it's all about safety and efficacy if we're going to open it up really to the masses. Like, essentially, I think the whole process is reasonable. It just does move so slow.
It's so exciting, though. I'm glad it's moving slow.
Yeah.
Because it only has to move slow once.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, that's the beauty of it, is if we do it right the first time, then, you know, behind MDMA potentially comes psilocybin. You know, there's a path, there are systems in place for processing paperwork more efficiently than we did the first time through.
Right.
You know, there are relationships that are made, like the governing agencies who are trained and genuinely are trying to protect us from the potential harms of these things, see that we're serious, that we're real serious scientists.
Yes.
That we are not, you know, giving people things and sending them out into the street, you know, that we are careful in how we've analyzed how safe these things are. Like, that route has only, like you said, only has to be done once. It goes slow, but really only has to be done once. That's the beauty of the scientific method. That's the beauty of doing scientific research. That's the beauty of publications. Once something is published, it's the word. It is the word until a better scientist comes and proves you wrong.
Wow.
And if you don't get proven wrong, that's the word. Metaphor again. It's like you figured out a piece of what God was trying to say.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What God was trying to show you or whatever.
Sure.
You know.
You've
found a truth.
You found a truth.
A true, true truth. And it's there. How you found that truth is detailed in your methodology. Anyone is welcome to try to prove that you were wrong.
Right.
Anyone is welcome to try and interpret your stuff in a different way.
Yes.
And they do. That's the beauty of science. There's no cabal of scientists. Scientists hate each other. Scientists make a name by slaying other scientists.
I've seen it. You know, I just actually threw it away. I wish I'd kept it for you. Have you read the research lambasting the concept that DMT is some kind of endogenous chemical
pineal gland?
Yeah,
stuff.
Have you seen that? Someone at the Ram Dass retreat gave me this like study just lambasting.
Just embarrassing.
Just saying, like, look, this is, like, not what's in the human brain when you die. Or, like, it's...
Right. It was a neat postulation by somebody who worked with DMT, and I won't say their name because, you know, obviously it seems like it isn't true, and it wasn't something that they said with any scientific backing. It was a complete, like, you know... I think maybe this is what's going on, and this is, you know.
I wish
and that turned that into this, like, oh, it was a scientist said it, so it's a scientific fact, and you
but
know,
the
got
tone
way
of the
control.
Paper. The tone of the paper.
Yeah.
That's what's, I don't
They're
think
mean,
people,
man, I'm
people,
telling
that's
you. Scientists
what
do not, there is no conspiracy.
Because people don't know that, like, these papers can be written, like, as though you're reading some kind of angry movie critic from
oh,
the
Oh, my
like,
goodness, yes.
Just vicious.
Yeah.
Just slang, like, oh, really? You think this stuff comes out of your brain
right.
when you die? Actually, here's what's in the brain of, like, mice, and here's what it is. And so,
right. Which, they lay out their science in, like, just razor sharp, meant to kill your
meanwhile,
idea.
I can't go back in time and fix all the conversations I had with people.
Where you
I'm
told
like,
people that. And you know something about, like, misinformation is you have to tell somebody 7 times. You have to correct it 7 times before it gets through to them.
Then I have to correct it. You know? Then I have to, like, say it like
you have to
40,
go find all those
times.
Conversations, and you have to have the correcting conversation 7 times with each one.
And, like, I have to assume that people are going to remember the conversation because probably right. we're high as kites. And I'm like, hey, man, you know this stuff gets produced in your brain when you die, baby. It's
oh,
like,
no.
No, it's not true.
Ripple effects, man.
Ripple effects. Cole, I know that you, I love how measured you are with this. I know how, I love it, but I know you must be giddy about getting to be part of this study.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I'm giddy knowing you are part of it and just
right.
feeling what that's like to be on the brink
right.
of something that is going to be one of the most profound shifts
yeah.
in our treatment of MDMA and potentially other psychedelics that's happened.
Absolutely.
In
it's
history.
It is a total blessing and it is amazing. And yeah, I'm very excited. I mean, it's all I think about and it's all I talk about and it's all I do. So, like, to be able to really be a part of it is it's fulfilling.
Is there any way we can help folks listening, anything you can do?
Absolutely, especially right now. Pineapple Fund, a fund is having a donation matching drive right now, maps.org, to get more details about that. But we are down to the last handful of millions of dollars. If anybody has a handful of millions, that would be great. That would get the drive done very quickly. But somebody very generous has donated, has offered a price or a donation matching opportunity right now. They are putting up half of the expected remaining costs of
wow.
the study. And if we can raise the other half and maybe beyond, this, because the study, again, you know, is being funded. We don't have any government grants. We don't have any drug company grants. This is being funded by the people who potentially are going to benefit, and their families and their communities and their fellow compassionate human beings. So, it's all funded by donations. So, go to maps.org and get us over the finish line.
Thank you so much, Cole. You're the best.
Thank
Keep
you
up
so
good
much,
work.
Duncan.
Marta, for appearing on this episode. All the links you need to find him will be located at duncantrussell.com. A big thanks to HelloFresh.com for sponsoring this episode. And don't forget to go to patreon.com/DTFH to subscribe. Give us a nice rating on iTunes. Enjoy your existence as a transient mote of sentience being vaporized by time. Call someone and tell you that you love yourself and give your dog a big hug. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.